Welcome to Torah Imecha Nachumi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Lynn Kraft, and today we will be learning Melachim Bet, Perek Yud-Chet, Chapter 18. In the last Perek, Perek Yud-Zayin, Chapter 17, we learned about Galut Aseret HaShvatim, the exile of the 10 tribes by Ashur. Malchut Yisrael was destroyed, its temples razed, its people displaced throughout the rest of the Assyrian Empire. And we're told that this was a punishment for the terrible sins perpetrated by the kings and people of Malchut Yisrael since its inception. And then other peoples from elsewhere in the empire were brought in to live in Malchut Yisrael and ultimately became known as the Shomronim because they lived there. They were Avodah Zarah worshippers who initially were attacked by lions upon moving into the land, but after learning how to worship Hashem, they lived there peacefully from then on. Psukim Aleph Tibet, verses 1 to 2 of our parak, go back in time a few years in order to discuss the next king of Malchut Yehuda, who began his reign before Ashur exiled the people of Malchut Yisrael during the third year of Hoshea ben Ela's reign. After the death of Ahaz, who was a pro-Assyrian, Avodah Zarah worshipping king, we're now introduced to his son, Chizkiyahu here, who became king at 25 years old and ruled in Yerushalayim for 29 years. Psukim Gimel through Zion, verses 3 through 7, describe Chizkiyahu as a spiritually unique king. At first, the standard protocol for describing righteous kings is used, Vayas Hayashar Be'enei Hashem, and he did what was straight in the eyes of Hashem, Kechol Asher Asad David Aviv, like all that his father David did. The Psukim then continued to detail exactly how great Chizkiyahu was. He actually removed the bamot, the platform scattered throughout the kingdom, upon which the people had been bringing sacrifices to Hashem for years, even though their use in the worship of Hashem had been outlawed since Shlomo's building of the Beit HaMikdash. And this is the first time that even a righteous king in Malchut Yehuda took action to remove the bamot. Until now, every righteous king was introduced with the fact that he did what was right in the eyes of Hashem, just that he did not remove the bamot. And now, for the first time ever, Chizkiyahu actually did exactly that. And Chizkiyahu went even further as well, destroying all the Avodah Zarah that his father had introduced to the kingdom. He also destroyed the Nachash and Nechoshet made by Moshe Rabbeinu in the Midbar, because until Chizkiyahu's time, likely since his father's reign, Bnei Yisrael had been making offerings to it, since they viewed it as having godly powers. Why did they view it as having these divine powers? Because it had cured their ancestors of their plague in the Midbar in the wilderness. And we're told that Chizkiyahu called it the Nechushtan in order to remind the people that it was merely made of copper and didn't actually have any divine power. In fact, in Divrei Hayamim Bet, Prakim Chavtet through Lamed Aleph, chapters 29 through 31, we're told that in the first year of his reign, Chizkiyahu restored the Beit HaMikdash by strengthening its doors and purifying it. This was unfortunately necessary because Ahaz had defiled it and transformed it into an Assyrian shrine to Avodah Zarah and had barred all worship of Hashem there. And it was right after this purification process was completed that Chizkiyahu sent messengers throughout not only Malchut Yehuda, but also throughout all of Malchut Yisrael, as we had discussed when we learned our last parak, Parak Yud-Zayin, chapter 17, when he invited everyone to do tshuva and celebrate Pesach Sheni in the Beit HaMikdash together because they had missed celebrating actual Pesach on time because the Beit HaMikdash wasn't yet purified by them. As we learned, this was the first time the people of Malchut Yisrael were able to worship Hashem in the Beit HaMikdash in centuries, since the split of the kingdom. And after the celebrations were over, we're told that Chizkiyahu reinstituted the Trumot and the Maasrot and other gifts due to the Kohanim to support their work in the Beit HaMikdash, and that the people responded very positively. Returning to Sefer Melachim, we're told in Psukim Hey through Zion, verses 5 through 7, that Chizkiyahu had faith in Hashem and cleaved unto him, keeping all of his mitzvot, and as a result, Hashem was with him in all of his pursuits. The spiritual heights he was able to attain were so unique that Va'acharav lo haya kamohu, and after him there was no one like him, Bechol Malchei Yehuda, and all the kings of Judah, Va'asher hayu lefanav, and of those who preceded him. But how is it possible that Chizkiyahu religiously surpassed every single king who preceded him? Was he really greater than even David and Shlomo? So Radak explains this phrase to mean that Chizkiyahu was greater than all the kings who preceded him, except for David and Shlomo. The Malbim notes that the beginning of the pasuk specifically refers to Chizkiyahu's bitachon b'Hashem, his faith in Hashem, and that specifically in this realm of his faith in Hashem, he surpassed all those who preceded him, including even David and Shlomo, but not necessarily in other things. Ralbag and Barbanel both posit that, in fact, Chizkiyahu was considered better religiously than even David and Shlomo in general, since they both sinned, right? David sinned with Bathsheba, Shlomo sinned with his marrying foreign wives and allowing them to continue worshipping their foreign gods, whereas Chizkiyahu didn't sin at all. In Pasuk Zayin, verse 7, we're told that it wasn't only his father's idolatry that Chizkiyahu decided had to go, but also his father's Ashur foreign policy. Vayimrod b'melech Ashur v'lo avado, and he rebelled against the king of Ashur and did not serve him. Now, why was Chizkiyahu so intent on rebelling against Ashur, the greatest superpower on earth at the time, when they were already poised to destroy his neighbors to the north, which meant that his southern kingdom would likely be next? Probably because Ahaz's vassal status to Ashur meant that not only did he have to serve the Assyrian emperor, but also the Assyrian gods. Remember how due to his alliance with Tiglath-Pileser, Ahaz had their pagan altar replicated and used it to replace the Mizbeach HaNehoshet, the copper altar in the Beit HaMikdash. It seems that Chizkiyahu understood that he could not restore the nation's loyalty to Hashem without first eradicating its loyalty to Ashur. And to Chizkiyahu, loyalty to Hashem took precedence over national security needs. Perhaps this is actually what Pasuk Hey, verse 5, was referring to when it told us that Chizkiyahu's bitachon b'Hashem, his trust in Hashem, was stronger than any of his predecessors and all those who followed him, because he had confidence that even if his giving up his alliance with Ashur would lead them to attack him, Hashem would save him and his people, and it was therefore worth it in order to overthrow their idolatrous influence over his kingdom. In other words, Chizkiyahu's trust in Hashem enabled him to correctly prioritize his kingdom's spirituality over its position in international politics, because he knew that Hashem would save them regardless. And even Shlomo did not reach this level of bitachon, as he seems to prioritize his regional standing over Hashem's Torah, by continuously establishing alliances with his neighbors through marrying their king's daughters, despite Hashem's warnings against kings having too many wives, and despite the fact that these wives weren't even Jewish, and even if they ended up converting, they ended up bringing their negative pagan influences into his kingdom. In Pasuk Chet, verse 8, we're told of Chizkiyahu's successful military campaigns against the Plishtim. But this kind of seems like a random intrusion of irrelevant information in the middle of an overarching discussion of Chizkiyahu's relationship with Ashur, which will continue in the next several psukim. So why is it even included here? Why do we care about the Plishtim? According to the Barbanel, this detail was inserted to make sure that we're aware of Chizkiyahu's, or that we're aware that Chizkiyahu's religious piety didn't come at the expense of his military strength. The Balbim suggests that this detail actually continues to highlight the contrast between Chizkiyahu and his father Ahaz in terms of their military strength. Because whereas Ahaz was attacked by Malchut Yisrael and Aram, and he therefore thought he needed Ashur's help, which is why he served Ashur in the first place, also the Plishtim were spread throughout the land during his reign. On the other hand, Chizkiyahu didn't need Ashur's help at all, and he was therefore able to stop serving him, and furthermore, he was able to conquer the Plishtim as well. In Sukkim Tethri Yudbet, verses 9 through 12, we're told again of Ashur's destruction of Malchut Yisrael and exiling of his people, as was previously described in detail in Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17. But this time we're informed that the siege and capture of Shomron occurred during the 4th to 7th years of Chizkiyahu's reign. We're told in Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13, that 7 years later, during the 14th year of Chizkiyahu's reign, Sancheriv, who is the new Assyrian emperor, attacked and conquered all of the walled cities of Malchut Yehuda, including the second most prominent city of the kingdom, known as Lachish. Actually, the conquest of Lachish is inscribed in detail on several ancient Assyrian reliefs that were discovered in Sancheriv's palace, having been used to decorate the palace walls. And that just corroborates what we know of here in Tanakh. The only city left in Malchut Yehuda not under Sancheriv's control at this point was its capital, Yerushalayim. Unsurprisingly, soon afterward, Yerushalayim became Sancheriv's next target. And we're told in Zirah HaYamim Bet, Perek Lamed Bet, chapter 32, that when Chizkiyahu saw that Sancheriv had set his sights on Yerushalayim, he prepared the city for its inevitable siege in 5 different ways. First, he sealed up the natural water sources that were located right outside the city walls so that the Assyrian army would not be able to benefit from them while they camped there. He also fortified the walls of Yerushalayim, sealing up all the broken portions of the walls, building up the walls to be as high as their towers, and also building an additional external wall. He trained his army, boosted their morale, he stocked up on food, he stocked up on arms, and perhaps most famously, he had his people carve an underground water tunnel in order to reroute the waters of the Gihon Spring away from the exposed outer wall of the city, where the Assyrian forces could have easily conquered it when besieging the city, and towards an area further inside the city, away from the city walls, today referred to as Brichat HaShiloach, or the Siloam Pool. If anyone has ever visited Chizkiyahu's water tunnel in Ir David, that's exactly what we're referring to here. Yet even more than a refreshing tourist destination on a scorchingly hot Israeli summer day, this tunnel was actually a wonder of ancient engineering. An ancient tablet was even discovered inside the tunnel, inscribed in ancient Hebrew script, and that describes the tunnel's miraculous method of construction, in which two teams actually started chiseling through the rock at opposite ends of the city. And without cell phones or any other modern-day detection equipment or technology, the two teams miraculously met in the middle. The tablet actually describes the moment when the men met each other. And I quote, "While the axes were against each other and while three cubits were left to cut, the voice of a man called to his counterpart. For there was Zada," we don't know what that is, "in the rock on the right and on the left. And on the day of the tunnel being finished, the stonecutter struck each man towards his counterpart, axe against axe, and water flowed from the source to the pool for 1,200 cubits." After engaging in all these preparations for a potential siege of Yerushalayim, Chizkiyahu still attempted to forestall Sennacherib's advance in Psukim Yudalet through Tetzayin, verses 14 through 16, sending messengers to him in Lachish with an offer to pay whatever tribute he wanted. Sennacherib responded by charging Chizkiyahu 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold, which he paid using all the silver in the Beit HaMikdash and in the king's treasury, and by stripping the gold off the doors and the doorposts of the Beit HaMikdash. And if you recall, he began his kingdom strengthening these very doors after Ahaz had destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, and now he has to strip the doors he had strengthened in order to pay off Sennacherib. In Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17, we're told that Sennacherib sent his representatives to Yerushalayim, led by Rav Shakei, his head wine butler. Like Rav means head, and Shakei, like Lahashkot, means to give to drink. And he sent this Rav Shakei with a message for Chizkiyahu. In Pasuk Yud Chet, verse 18, the king's officers greeted Sennacherib's men, and in Psukim Yotet through Chafei, verses 19 through 25, Rav Shakei publicly launched into a long speech that, while explicitly directed to the king, Chizkiyahu was in actuality intended for the people of Yerushalayim in an attempt to convince them to surrender to Sennacherib. And this agenda can be seen clearly through a close reading of Rav Shakei's speech. In Pasuk Yotet, verse 19, Rav Shakei began, "Imruna el Chizkiyahu, please say to Chizkiyahu, Ko amar hamelach hagadol melach Ashur, so said the great king, the king of Assyria, Ma habitachon hazeh asher batachta, what is this confidence in which you trusted?" Already in this first sentence, we see how differently Rav Shakei depicts each king. He referred to Chizkiyahu merely by his name, devoid of any royal title, while he referred to Sennacherib as Hamelach HaGadol, Melach Ashur, the great king, the king of Assyria. And this was really intentional, with the purpose of convincing the people that they should choose to have the powerful Sennacherib lead them rather than remain under the weak Chizkiyahu's rule. We also see Rav Shakei using the shorish of Bet Tet Chet, trust, twice in this pasuk. In fact, the shorish is found seven times throughout this initial speech, making the word bitachon, confidence, the milah mancha, or the repeating word of this discourse. Rav Shakei used the word to claim that the two other kings upon whom Chizkiyahu had relied to defeat Sennacherib were not worthy of his bitachon, of his confidence. So first he contended that Paro Melech Mitzrayim could not be relied upon, because he would soon just turn around and hurt Chizkiyahu. He actually compared Paro to a reed that one believes one can lean on, but when one actually does lean upon it, its sharp end will just pierce one's hand. And then he continued by claiming that Hashem certainly cannot be relied upon to save Chizkiyahu, because Hashem was angry at Chizkiyahu for having removed his altars when Hashem specifically commanded the people to worship him with that altar in Yerushalayim. Now, this is obviously untrue, because the altars Chizkiyahu had removed and destroyed were either the bamot, the platforms that people illegitimately built and used outside the Beit HaMikdash, which we just saw Chizkiyahu being praised for doing, or it's referring to the altars his father Ahaz had designated for Avodah Zarah, both of which made Hashem thrilled that Chizkiyahu removed them because they were forbidden by his Torah, right? But Sennacherib, a pagan king, couldn't imagine any scenario in which a god would want the altars in his city removed from use by its king. So he just assumed that Hashem would have been upset with Chizkiyahu for doing this. And furthermore, Rav Shakei argued, it was Hashem himself who had sent Sennacherib to attack Yerushalayim. And if Hashem wanted Sennacherib to defeat Chizkiyahu, how could Chizkiyahu rely on Hashem to save him from Sennacherib? And so, you know, looking back on this speech, it seems that Rav Shakei's overarching message was, don't rely on either Paro or Hashem, and therefore don't rely on Chizkiyahu. Rather, rely on Sennacherib, who will be victorious. In Pasuk Chavav, verse 26, Chizkiyahu's officers asked Rav Shakei to continue speaking in Aramaic instead of in Hebrew, because they didn't want the masses of people now gathered at the wall to be able to understand what he was saying. As career politicians, they understood Aramaic, the lingua franca of the Assyrian Empire, but the people of Malchut Yehuda only understood their own native Hebrew. And Rabshakeh's speech was demoralizing to the people as it was trying to turn them against both their king and their god, so the officers didn't want him to continue speaking to them in a way that they could understand. The real question here is how Rabshakeh, who was Sancheir's head wine butler and obviously spoke Aramaic as an Assyrian, how did he know how to speak Hebrew? So possibly it was because he too was a career politician, so he understood the other languages of the region. But Chazal actually suggests in the Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Samach Amid Aleph that Rabshakeh knew Hebrew since he was an apostate, meaning he was a Jew who went rogue and later joined the Assyrians. So he knew Hebrew because he was Jewish himself originally. In Pasuk of Zion, verse 27, Rabshakeh refused to grant the officer's request that he speak in Aramaic because his entire goal was for the people to hear him so that he can intimidate them into surrender. So of course he wanted them to understand exactly what was going on. In Psukim Chavchet through Lamed Hei, verses 28 through 35, Rabshakeh continued for a second time to speak in Hebrew, but this time he used a different Mila Mancha or repeating word, Hitzil, which means to save. And he implored the people not to listen to Chizkiyahu, who claimed that Hashem would be able to save them, for none of the other nations' gods were able to save them from Ashur, including Hashem himself, who wasn't able to save Shomron from the Assyrian onslaught. And so Rabshakeh tried to convince them that only Sancheiriv could save them, and that by making peace with Sancheiriv, he would offer them security and economic prosperity. But by disparaging God in this way, Rabshakeh unwittingly invited another player into the upcoming battle between him and Chizkiyahu, Hashem himself. Because we know that when Hashem's power is challenged, he always makes sure to prove his superior might. We saw this in Melachim Aleph, Peret Chaf, chapter 20, when Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram's generals, claimed that Hashem only has power on mountains, but not in valleys. And again in Melachim Bet, Peret Gimel, chapter 3, when Mesha, the king of Moab, attributed his military successes in the Mesha steal against Malchut Yisrael to his god Chemosh. And in both instances, Hashem made sure to make it very clear to both Aram and Moab who was really in charge. And so the confrontation has now been escalated. In Pasuk Lamed Vav, in verse 36, we're told that the nation was quiet and did not respond to Rabshakeh at all, since the king Chizkiyahu had commanded them not to answer him. They actually listened. And in the last Pasuk of the Perek, Pasuk Lamed Zion, verse 37, the king's officers tore their clothing and told the king what Rabshakeh had said. Sancheiriv's arrogance here in telling Bnei Yisrael through Rabshakeh that Hashem can't save them, but rather he can, is set up in stark contrast to Chizkiyahu's humble response to this speech in the next parak, in Parak Chaf Hei, chapter 25, when we will see him appealing to Hashem to save him and his people. This year is dedicated by Michelle Levine and Susan Schuster and their families in memory of their beloved mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, Rebbetzin Gloria Leff, Goldet Tzivia Ba Baruch. Rebbetzin Leff was a highly regarded principal and Torah teacher, a master educator, whose deep love for teaching Tanakh inspired hundreds of students throughout her lifetime.